Well, we are back. My name is Olivia.
I'm Tony.
I'm Anna.
Scott.
Adam.
And today we're going to be looking at the 2005 documentary, The Devil and Daniel Johnston. This documentary focuses on the life of Daniel Johnston, and he had a few mental health concerns, but it really focuses on his life throughout his upbringing as far as all that he's been involved in, such as songwriting, his life as an artist, as well as songwriter, artist, and
screenwriter.
He did a lot. So in this film, we'll talk about the mental health concerns, but as traditionally we've talked about the helping professional within these films, but this film has a different twist. So we'll talk about that role as well and how it kind of shifts.
Well, and I wanted to share a couple anecdotes related to Daniel Johnston. I've never met him, but how I first heard of his music. And let me say, as an aside, throughout watching, I was just really fascinated by just this incredible creativity and how he recorded music. And it was so primitive, going from like one tape recorder to another. And I can relate to that, because during that same time period, I was writing songs, I was performing, no place famous or anything, just at open mics and local establishments. But I was doing that same kind of process, so I could identify with that. Second, as I try to say on every episode, my favorite band is The Replacements, and in 1994, at kind of the beginning of the internet in terms of popular use, I was on a listserv called The Skyway, dedicated to The Replacements, and through The Skyway, some of us on there put together a tribute to The Replacements. And so there, I had three songs on there. The Replacements have they have a live cassette, essentially, that somebody in the audience was recording their show, and a bouncer or roadie found that, and then they listened to it and they liked it, and they released it under the title The Shit Hits the Fans. So in this tribute to The Replacements, where we were recording our own songs, people who were fans of The Replacements, was called The Fans Hit Back, compiled by Mark Timmons, another Replacements fan. And so I had a few songs on there. Additionally, my favorite song, and that Fans Hit Back might be my favorite album of all time. My favorite song on there was done by an internet friend of mine named Teddy James. I think his group might have been Deep Eddy. It was called Walking the Cow. And I just used to listen to that over and over again, not realizing that that was a Daniel Johnston song, and until I watched this documentary, and there it is again. So, and in addition to that, like I have from the 90s, my favorite music era, sort of, I've got Daniel Johnston on the same CD as Tori Amos and Collective Soul and Juliana Hatfield and Victoria Williams, and it's just a Christmas CD called You Slay Me. And Daniel does Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And so I wasn't listening to this as sort of this outlandish, creative, primitive folk artist. I was just listening to him as another rock star. And so that was how I got introduced to Daniel.
I had actually never heard of Daniel Johnston before this. And when I looked up the film, I started watching a different film accidentally, The Devil and Daniel Webster, which I remembered was actually, it had been remade a few years back. And I was like, oh, this is why everything sounded familiar when we talked about it. But then I started watching this film, and it's completely different than The Devil and Daniel Webster. So, yeah, I mean, I'm very curious to get everyone's ideas and thoughts about what, you know, they thought of the film. There was a little shout-out to Kent State University, where he was attending an art program at their East Liverpool branch, which is where I have my first master's degree from, so it made me feel a little bit more connected. And then I was like, oh my gosh, they all must be from Ohio, and it turns out they're not. They're from West Virginia, but it kind of borders West Virginia and Pennsylvania. East Liverpool does, so it made me feel a little connection there with the whole Kent State. I've taught at Kent State University and their branch in Geauga, so it made me feel a little connection there with Daniel Johnston.
I could not connect with this movie. It was very kind of difficult to watch, just because, like, it was a documentary, and sometimes documentaries are just, like hard-hitting truths, and there's no, like, dramatization or anything. I had to pause it, like, several times, because it's just, like, maybe it was just, okay, don't get mad, but the music wasn't, like, meshing well with me, and I was like, ugh.
I'll agree with you. I could not get into the music either.
I was like, at the time, it was probably, like, great, and but to me, I was just like, I could see where his talent was, but it's just not my kind of music. I'm not really an alternative or, like, anything rock-related.
And I don't know if we all just have great counselor attending skills, but I noticed every single one of us were shaking our heads when you were saying certain parts of that. So I don't know if it's our counseling attending skills or whether we all can kind of agree to some point with what was said there.
It was definitely different, and there were a few times where the documentary was a little overwhelming or emotional, simply because of it reflects the experience that the characters in the documentary, or the people in the documentary, and Daniel Johnston were feeling, and they were so, these feelings were so intense, these situations were so dramatic, I guess, that, you know, it kind of leapt out of the documentary. But yeah, definitely a different style of music, but it was also that brought up that question of genius, creativity, and mental illness, and that spectrum, and the appearance of that genius, that different sound, that different artwork, and how other people perceive it.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. While watching it, I could see the whole, like, genius, crazy, like, complex. You know how some people describe some people as a genius, but other people think they're crazy?
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the whole, going back to the first movie we watched, Good Will Hunting, with the, what was it, Albert Einstein, Ted Kaczynski, that mm-hmm. type of dynamic. I could see that, because some people really were just like, he's such an amazing songwriter. And then people, like certain people in his family, were just like, yeah, he was a little out there and he was a little weird. So I saw that a lot.
Well, I definitely didn't know anything about Daniel Johnston. However, for some reason, I thought of, even though the music was different, I thought it was very therapeutic. Mm-hmm. Hearing his emotions and to be able to record them. And as we talk about his upbringing, I'm sure we'll get to that later, being in that type of home environment but still being able to express yourself, and even if they just listened to the words he was saying, I think that in itself would have brought some type of sense of understanding to, you know, my son, or what's going on with my brother. Because he really expressed himself very plainly, and it reminded me of a lot of artists today, in a sense, like you have, you know, your Drake and everyone, I'm going through heartbreak. This is, Daniel knows all about heartbreak, and he writes it well. Like, he's going to tell you what's on his mind, and it's going to be as simple as saying, she's with another guy. Like, there's no, it's not... It's all, it's like, it's creative, because he's doing the music himself, is in composing it, writing the songs, playing the piano, but then also he's being really authentic and allowing his experiences to motivate him, which a lot of artists do. So in that sense, although I was like, I've never heard of this guy, I did have some strong reactions into, you know, mental health. Is important, and especially its awareness and education component to families, because his family definitely needed, you know, it was needed to express here's what's going on, because there was a lot of just be normal. And what's normal again? Like, you see today, like, the way people are acting, so.
Right. It's like define normal.
And I know when it comes to music, there is no right and wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like this is good music, this is bad music, because everyone's going to disagree on that.
Yeah.
But when it comes to his genius as music, I guess I just don't see it. Because, I mean, I got the idea that he was an incredible pianist, and it was something that he didn't prefer, though. He really wanted to use the guitar instead. And I'm going to call it spade a spade, he could not play the guitar. And when I listened to that, I was like, okay, maybe the lyrics were there. Maybe there were some great, great lyrics, right?
So like you're comparing the two. It's not lyrics or guitar. We're just going to say.
Well, then I was like, let me read the lyrics. And I'm like, these were written by a six-year-old. Like, they are expressive. But I didn't think they were genius in any way. And maybe it was kind of interesting that, like, when it came to his mental health issues, he didn't have as much of a filter as maybe other people would, and he did say things that other people wouldn't have said,
mm-hmm.
where I can see kind of that creativity there, but I don't know if I'd call it genius versus just disturbed, maybe, or perplexed.
You know what?
I think...
Go ahead, Adam. What I associate it with is, like, modernist art. Or like avant-garde art in music or writing, where I don't necessarily understand it and I may not think it's like beautiful, but there's this some idea there and some experts that see what I am not trained to see or I have
yeah,
no
there's
experience
something
with. However, I do agree with Olivia that it was a direct window into kind of his soul and his mind where we could see the effects of, you know, whether it was the mental illness, the struggles that he was, the stress that he was going through, that battle that we saw, like, on his pictures with him beating up the monster within himself. All of that came out through his art, through his videos, through his songs, and I think that and that underlying, like, oh, this is new, this is, like, avant-garde, this is a new direction, and many times he wasn't performing in, like, you know, huge mainstream studios, he was mostly performing in underground, you know, folksy, you know, venues, so, you know, for that crowd.
Maybe what I'm trying to think is, like, it was the 80s, so maybe it was not, there weren't that many artists who were just being flat out with how they feel. I don't know. I don't know how the music scene was kind of, like, poppy.
I don't think so. Gosh, this reminds me of our Ordinary People discussion where we're attributing everything to the 80s because some of us weren't born yet, and so we don't know what that was like.
Yeah.
So his genre, the genre of his music, I just looked it up on the People's Knowledge Wikipedia, and it's and the genre is called outsider music or lo-fi music, and I think, Tony, your initial reaction, which seems to be shared by others in our group, and Adam has verbalized this, like, here we're being told that this music is so great. And the opening scene, I forget the exact how he was introduced, but something to the effect of the world's greatest singer and songwriter, Daniel Johnston. And he comes out, and what we hear does not sound like the greatest singer and songwriter. And I think that creates some tension and dissonance in us. And in a way, I think it's kind of the essence of this film or a major theme in it.
Yeah, like in one of the scenes he said, oh, I made this while I was having a mental breakdown.
Yes.
I feel like he was popular because, like, he wasn't, like, shy about, like, what he was going through. Like, you said, like, he let it all out, and you said it sounded like it was written by, like, a six-year-old, but maybe it was just written by a heartbroken, angsty teen. Like, I got the feeling that he couldn't really tell, like, when especially when it came to like women, like when they were just friends and when like they were more than friends, because he was obsessed over the girl with the boyfriend and then she got married, and then his friend who was helping him out, he started calling her
Kathy.
His girlfriend. Yeah. Yeah. And then he made a song like Kathy Didn't Want Me Back or something like that.
Yeah.
Just like, it's okay. I see the intent. It's just maybe because like I'm not really into outsider music or lo-fi or...
I think there was a point in the documentary where Kathy, I think, was speaking about this, where she was like, yeah, there are some people who absolutely loved his stuff, but for many people, it was too much. And they just didn't know how to react to him. They didn't know how to react to his music. And another point, or another part of the film where I think he... they're talking about how he was on medication, he was feeling better, but then a couple of weeks before the show, he stopped taking his medication because in his mind, or perhaps in reality, people seemed to like him better when he was quote-unquote more crazy or more out there, where his like creativity juices like went overboard, you know, or he was that expressive. And so I think that's actually one kind of devastating aspect of creativity and medicine and drugs, where sometimes it feels like, you know, you can be more creative in a state that may be harmful to yourself.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, because I was a huge, huge, huge Amy Winehouse fan. And when she sobered up, like, the music she made I still enjoyed, but there just wasn't something there, or the angst or something.
Yeah,
was just missing, and I still loved it, and I wish she was still around and sober, but I think you made a really good point there. There's something about not being in reality that creates kind of this this persona,
or just the
activity.
Adversity or anything, like a breakup. Breakup music is
the,
awesome.
It's the best.
Happy music is like, gosh, like,
was
you're just too happy. You're just too happy.
I'm not a country fan, but give me a sad country song. Oh my God, give me some Lady Antebellum. And I'm just like, yes, right in the heart. Okay. It's just, I understand, because I really love like the artist Kid Cudi. And recently, he has come out and like expressed all these mental illnesses or mental health issues. And he actually came out, I think he came out with a song or a mixtape prior to this. And it did not sound, in my opinion, the same as his like Man on the Moon album, which I'm in love with. And me and all my friends grew up listening to it. And it's just like, it's like Whitney before and then Whitney after. It's like two different people.
Drugs didn't work for Whitney.
It didn't. It didn't. It was just like, you know how people will be really good and then get on drugs and then sound really bad? Some people sound better when they're going through it, even though that's really bad to say.
And
it's just
different,
a different...
opinion.
It's different.
But this makes me think of a theme among like everything that we are saying, is that fascination with the unknown, the strange, the creative, the, like something we're not used to, where, you know, it's fascinating from one aspect and from another it's alienating. So we don't quite connect to the artist, or we don't quite connect to somebody that we may consider schizophrenic or having a psychotic break, but because we are not able to connect as much, it is fascinating. It's like, what is going on in your head? What is going on within you? And what can we learn from it? And that expression.
Yeah. So I think we had the same question, but was he schizophrenic or like manic depressive?
I think they diagnosed him as manic depressive in the documentary, but his diagnosis might have changed or like later on into schizophrenia.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Manic depressive is bipolar.
Correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
We don't. Yeah. That's
with psychotic features.
Yeah.
Yes. So bipolar is the term that we use now.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But there and within the documentary, Daniel made reference, or people about Daniel made reference several times to either being in a manic state or a depressive state.
Yeah.
So,
which I definitely saw that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there was also some elements of delusion.
Mm-hmm.
There definitely were.
And I wanted to
demons.
Determine,
well,
like,
yeah.
There was a question on whether he was using acid at the time.
Didn't they say he was?
He took it for a period of time.
Yeah, but then there was the one guy they interviewed, and he said, no, I didn't give him acid at the time.
Well, yeah, that was Gabby Hayes, the lead singer of the Butthole Surfers.
Oh, okay.
But he said that he himself did not give Daniel acid, but Daniel was taking a lot of acid at that time.
Yeah.
And that did seem to lead up to the part that was his biggest psychotic break.
Mm-hmm.
And the time he was in New York and just going all over town and people couldn't find him,
mm-hmm.
etc. It did seem like it was escalating.
Yeah.
I do want to point out, though, although the lyrics you say were very plain and simple, I think the fact that he coupled that with his art. So although he's saying, I am feeling heartbroken and this sucks, she has another guy, he would have these images where the torso is broken, and then you have other images of when he's feeling like he's empty. And the song is talking about, I think I lost my brain, but the image is his head is literally open.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see, even though I think there were supposed to be wings of something flying out, it almost also seemed hazardous, where it wasn't just wings, but it could have been like a Swiss knife or something.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I think the art was more intensive than his lyrics, and I think that in itself was saying the metaphors and all the other things that a lot of people use with folk, plain and simple. It's like, it's for the people, in the sense that I'm not going to exaggerate or give you a bunch of metaphors, but when you look at his images, they say it coincided with everything he was feeling and his songs. And so looking at, okay, you mentioned Anna, the boxing gloves, him and himself, there's an internal struggle. Then he sings about it, and then you look at the image, and now it kind of completes the picture versus just isolating it.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't wrap my head around the whole eyeball thing, so I was going to ask...
Dead dog's eyeball.
Yeah, I was going to ask, like, what... I couldn't understand, like, what... the purpose, like, did it start when he was younger and him and his friends would just like draw them and post them around? Because I remember the part where his mom was on tape yelling at him, like, you want to be the laughing stock and drawing these eyeballs, and like,
yeah, he caught her on audio.
Yeah.
And
that
then
was pretty funny.
He provoked her in order to get that recorded so that then he could make a film about it, which
that's kind of smart.
There is some cleverness involved there.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like what we still have lingering out that I just want to address before we move on is the art form.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have opinions on that as well.
So we seem to have mixed reactions from this group, which I think is fairly common. Now, so I do have some Daniel and Daniel related CDs.
Are you gonna play?
Did you get them from his manager?
No. I think I got these on Amazon and eBay and just scouring CD and record stores. But one is called "Welcome to My World: The Music of Daniel Johnston," and it's recorded by his brief girlfriend Kathy.
Mm-hmm.
And these are great songs, and they are very pleasing to the ear. And then a CD that came out right around the same time as this documentary is called The Late Great Daniel Johnston. It's two CDs. One CD is his original versions, and then the other are these same songs being covered by famous musicians and artists. And so even though for us, some of us seem to not particularly enjoy these songs, we need to recognize Kurt Cobain was Daniel Johnston's biggest fan and would wear that "Hi, how are you" cover t-shirt everywhere, including the cover of Rolling Stone. And another student in our master's program, shout out to Joe Mulder. And when we watched this film in class last year, she realized that the song that she and her husband danced to at their wedding, their first song as a couple, was a Daniel Johnston song, as recorded, I believe, by Wilco, who's another, Wilco and Jeff Tweedy, you know, these very famous legendary artists.
I've never heard of them.
They themselves are very appreciative of this music, even though for us, and perhaps because of some of the roughness, it's hard to do. And it reminds me, so I can bring this back to counseling, it reminds me back to what I teach about sometimes in our theories class, that sometimes the theorist, the person who came up with a theory, is not that best at implementing their own theory, and yet for other people they can do it as a work of art.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of my thought on that.
Yeah, it's like, whether it's the song or the actual therapeutic techniques, depending on your style, maybe it's a different beat, maybe you do a dance with it and it's not so abrupt and structured, chop. Like, I think that changes how it's perceived, and you can do the same thing with two different clients, and maybe it works with one and not the other. Different audiences, the audience then had mixed reactions, just as we have in this room, but...
Yeah, and so I want to come back to some things Anna had mentioned as well, like this combination of creativity and genius and mental health concerns.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this particular documentary, we watched this one, but there are similar others that deal with mental illness and creativity and music. Dig, which is about the bands Dandy Warhols and Brian Jonestown Massacre. New York Doll, about Arthur Killer Kane, bass player for the New York Dolls. You're Gonna Miss Me by Roki Erickson, about Roki Erickson and the 13th Floor Elevators. And even more recently, currently playing at film festivals, Who is Lydia Lovelace? And I was associate producer of that film. But she talks about what it's like to have bipolar disorder and how that relates to her creativity and music.
Mm-hmm.
So I think these are not separate constructs, but they're interacting.
Yeah. The film, the documentary even quoted that people usually say, they make a joke like, every artist is a little crazy. So
I kind of believe that. Just because, like, well, just there's a lot of what goes into being an artist, and you have to be really creative, especially now, because it seems like, especially in the music scene, it's almost been done once already, so you kind of have to, like, put your own spin on what's, like, what you're gonna do. And just the, like, the creativity aspect, you have to be able to, like, appeal, well, not in Daniel Johnston's case, he didn't really care about appealing to the masses. He just said how he felt, but other people really...
But he kind of did.
Yeah, he wants,
I mean,
to be on MTV.
The way that he wiggled his way onto MTV,
yeah,
that is,
yeah, he, like,
genius.
What did they say? He schemed his way,
yeah,
onto MTV.
And that particular performance, I thought was really good, even if you don't like the rest of his music. But he's there in front of the crowd playing guitar, singing, and we get that smile. And he had gone off of his medication a few weeks before, and so he's got that kind of manic energy, and he becomes really, really charming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And appealing, and it kind of draws people in.
It makes me think of that spectrum of quote-unquote weirdness that we as a society can accept. And if you fall into that spectrum, then you can become successful. And if you step out of it, there's a chance, whether, you know, somebody realizes that genius, or if there's a way that people can relate and can appreciate that, but it becomes increasingly harder to relate with for the quote-unquote normal masses.
Right.
Do you think that he fell into the spectrum, or he was kind of like outside the spectrum, which is why?
Well, in my opinion, when he would be okay socially, he would be okay, because he was able, he was invited to shows, he would headline for people, there was even a bidding war for signing him onto
yes.
the record.
Mm-hmm.
And so his music, coupled with sometimes his charm and his regular personality, yes, that would have worked. But there were times where his illness manifested in harmful ways, such as the accusing everybody of being Satanist or evil, or that
the delusions. Of his manager.
Yeah.
Trying to crash his father's plane. I mean, there were some very serious things.
That plane crash. I don't know if this is what you all were thinking about, but that's every time I watch it, that's emotional for me.
Oh my gosh! Yeah.
How I just feel how frightening for his dad.
And I want to talk about the parents, because they had strong emotions in this.
They surely did.
It was different seeing the parents this time, who are real people sitting in front of you having these emotions, versus actors.
Yeah. Yes.
So I definitely want to say that at some point, but I want Amir to add that.
Yeah, for sure. So when it worked great. But when those negative symptoms came through, it was difficult to relate with people and to maintain that personal connection with people, because people were scared of him. I mean, especially,
legitimately so.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I'd be a little afraid.
And I don't see the charm that has been brought up. I there wasn't any part of him that I saw that was like charming.
When he was a kid, like when he was a teenager, I saw a little bit of it, because he was kind of that like shy, nerdy kid that was like, oh, look at my stuff. Like, hey guys. Not so much. I personally kind of was creeped out by him as a person. Not only his voice and demeanor, but also, and this may sound superficial, but his outward appearance combined with his personality.
It was a very disheveled look.
I don't know.
Well, and I know certain medications as well can take effects on a person's outward appearance after years of using them, and I think that you kind of get a little bit of a fried sense with him.
Yeah, I attribute the majority of his disheveled and overweight appearance, I attribute that to medication side effects. I don't know what medications he was on.
I know lithium was a big one.
And that aloofness where you're trying to connect with him, you're trying to have a conversation with him, and he's just like not seeing you, and that can be very distancing for some people.
So on that charm topic, going back to the Austin filming of MTV, and he got into that performance, he did about 3 songs. Mm-hmm. I thought they were good. They did make reference to, he was voted best guitar player in Austin. Now,
which
you think about
that. Upset
about. There's a lot of good guitar players in Austin, but there is something about Daniel that was so appealing. I thought the charm probably ended around that point. I could also call attention to when he was in the hospital and thought he wanted to make a commercial for like Mountain Dew, I think it was.
Yeah.
I'm crazy about Mountain Dew. I could see that having a little charming appeal. But when he was running around New York and a threat to other people, and even his performances that now had taken on this huge religious zealotry, I thought that he was really losing that appeal.
Yeah. I respect what like you guys saw, and I kind of want to watch again and see if I get that impression, because what I got more of was like an intellectual disability that people kind of thought like, oh, look at that guy trying hard. Kind of like how Susan Boyle walked out and everyone was kind of like, what is this? And then when she was able to do something really great, people were like, look at you, Susan Boyle. Good.
Okay.
You go, girl. You know, and it's like, I got more of the impression of an intellectual disability where when he was able to do something, people were like, oh, you go, Daniel, or John Stone.
Yeah, I could see, like, in the earlier stages, like, of his life when his parents were talking about how charming he was and how many friends he had, and, like, when he was doing the little home movies, like, oh, that's so cute. But then it's like, aside from the MTV portion, I didn't really see the charm either. Mainly because I was still thinking, when it got to the MTV part, I was still thinking about the carnival and how he just like got a moped and went to a carnival and his parents couldn't find him and then he punched somebody and ran to a church. Like,
very manic.
That's very manic to me, and I think that...
Yes.
And I think he got punched.
Yeah, he got punched.
Something happened when he was... He was in the porta potty too long at the carnival.
And a carny was like pushing on it and then punching.
I love that you just say carny.
That's what they That's what they said in the movie. But the whole MTV aspect, it seemed really manic. It was like, to me, the very like point, like the highest point of his like manic state, and then it just kind of went all downhill from there.
Which one? With the carnival or the
MTV? Oh, no. When he was performing for MTV.
Okay.
Because like, that's
getting all the calls at McDonald's.
Yeah, when he was really, really... It was just like, that's what he ultimately wanted. And then when it was over, it's kind of just like, what next?
Oh, you mean like that? That's when...
Yeah, that's when like his like, manic started to...
We should probably be explaining some stuff a little bit more. Because I'm realizing I'm saying random things like... We get it, because we know he worked at McDonald's for years and years, and, like, we realize he did run off, in fact, and work with a carnival, but someone listening right now might be like, what? Are you guys manic? You're talking about a carnival, and then McDonald's.
Okay,
distractibility.
Yeah.
A little background. I believe that, and correct me if I'm wrong, he was sent to Texas to live with a relative.
With a sibling.
With a sibling, because... He wasn't doing well in school, and like he was getting shuffled around a lot, which I took note of. That, you know, like that probably didn't help him at all either, to get like shuffled around throughout the family and back and forth to
school.
And this
was at the age of probably a young adult.
Yeah, he was at a young adult age, and he just got some. I don't know if he saved up money and rented a moped. And just took off, and no one knew where he was, and then they found out he was at a carnival, and while at this carnival, he got into an altercation with a worker in the carnival, and then didn't know what to do, so he went to church.
Yeah, and
he got hit.
The church, you know, took him to the hospital and provided some help, and he was able to reconnect with his family.
So, yeah.
That part, to me... that was pivotal because his mom, I don't know the phrase she kept quoting to him. Something about he's an unserving prophet.
Mm-hmm. That's how he called himself, but it was the reverse of that. So he was a not unserviceable servant. Or something, or not unprofitable servant. There you go. Because they would spend money on him, but he wouldn't be doing anything to return back to society or to his family.
Yeah, and so it seemed like his parents, they did have their faith was very prominent in their life, but I felt at a certain point it said that. Daniel is unlike his family. And then when he's in the circus and the moment happens, like the guy hit him because he was taking too long in a porta potty. Like, come on, something's wrong with you. So I'm just like, first of all, it's something so trivial, like an act of aggression towards him. Like, he's not even instigating it.
We think. It's the story from him. Who also gave a completely different story when he broke into the woman's house from what really happened as well.
Okay. So with that, from him, or rather actually happening, the fact that he said he went to the church to get help, it almost is to me was a parallel to him saying he wants to go back to his parents. Because it did lead him back into their care after he was released.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, it's like all that upbringing and she's saying, you know, he's no good. And then he does have this incident and he's been away. And it's like, I have to go home. And he knew I could get help through this.
And it seemed like he became pretty obsessed with certain beliefs of the church and whatnot.
Yeah, let's go there.
Yeah.
And in my work with people with mental health issues who have delusions,
mm-hmm.
my anecdotal observation has been that these delusions often focus on the big existential themes of life. So death, religion, hell, heaven, love, good and evil.
Why are we here?
Politics, government.
Purpose.
And so with Daniel, some of the repeated things that come to mind, although this is art too. I have limited knowledge of art history, but I know Salvador Dali and other artists. They would have common themes from work of art to work of art, and as did Daniel. So we have Casper the Friendly Ghost, deals with death a little bit, maybe. We've got this frog figure from the Hi, How Are You drawing that keeps coming back.
Yeah,
I don't know how that fits in. Definitely fixated with the devil. And
death.
And with love for Lori Allen, who was just this random person that he barely even knew, but at his, I think, community college, or maybe it was Kent State, had a brief friendship with her.
So the charm, you remember you said you didn't see it? When he recorded her getting, telling her, asking her to say, I love you.
Yeah.
Charm.
And I still see it more as an intellectual disability being nice to someone who's just being themselves.
I mean, it doesn't have to be intellectual disability. Just like, you know how in the movies where it's like the nerd or like the geek and like the popular girls are really nice to him because he's so sweet and they're just like, oh, it's kind of like a pity thing. I'm struggling with the like charm versus pity because she had a boyfriend, so she didn't really love him.
Yeah.
I think Kathy more so saw the charm and the first girl more so was more like pity. Mm-hmm.
I could see
just
that.
Like friendly, yeah. Like, oh, I love you because I'm here.
Not sure about the intellectual disability, but it may have been.
And I'm not diagnosing. That
sure,
would be completely inappropriate of me.
Especially later on in his life, I thought it was more of that fascination with the macabre or the weirdness of him. So it's like watching a train wreck. I don't know. That's close to some of, you know, what Kathy was saying about him. You know, as she maintained her friendship and relationship with him, where it's like at certain times it was amazing to see him, but what she said was he always left a wake after him, and it was a wake of creativity and like followed by a wake of destruction.
And something I even read about him is people started to wonder at some point, I don't know whether he brought it up or someone else brought it up, but there was a question of, are they coming to see him? Are they coming to see if he's going to unravel in front of them?
Mm-hmm.
People like the madness. People like to see the train wreck. Absolutely.
People are so messy.
Yeah,
people are.
I think that's very valid.
But it's that theme of estrangement where I saw that duality with his friends where it's like, we're kind of terrified of you, but we still want to help you. We care about you. We want to get you back. We want to find you. We want to get you back to your parents. But at the same time, we don't want to deal with you. We want to get you help, but just like,
absolutely,
don't drag us down. And that can be really hard for people, especially in terms of support system. So for people who may need help navigating life or may need that support in instances where they may not be well enough to take care of themselves. Having that support is crucial, and when people around you are kind of scared of you or don't know what to expect from you or don't want to deal with you, that
or just don't even
difficult.
Owe it to you. I mean, like, I know I think it's great that we have, like, we're helpers in the field and we want to help people. But I couldn't say prior getting into this field, if I had just a friend who was dealing with something really serious that happened pretty early in our friendship, that I'd be like, I'm going to jump in and be the person who's going to help this person. Like, it's like, I've got my life, man, and I've got my stuff, and you seem kind of dangerous, and I'm getting the hell out of Dodge. You know what I mean? Which I think kind of brings into the family, who is kind of obligated, but also loves him and wants to help him. And I definitely want to take time to talk about the parents, because, oh my gosh, the emotional roller coaster of that.
We can jump into that.
Why don't you go ahead and start? Because you had brought up the scene with the father.
Well, I'm not quite letting go of the pity.
Okay.
So I'm thinking about that, and I'm tentatively not agreeing. And so it is possible that Kathy felt that, or his friends felt that, or the manager maybe. But we've got major recording artists, dozens of major recording artists recording his music. And I can't think that Sonic Youth and Nirvana and Wilco are experiencing pity for him.
No.
Instead, I think they're recognizing the power of these songs. And then because he does have issues, they're, like Sonic Youth at least, wanting to reach out and help. And then it kind of blew up in their faces.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just what I wanted to say about
that. No, that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, even when he gave his tape to the, I think it was a radio host.
Yeah.
And he said, listen to it. And the guy said, well, we're not reviewing it now. And he said, I didn't ask you to review it. I just said, listen to it. And he did. Like, he
and he thought it was genius.
Yeah.
And those are the same songs that he's calling genius that we ourselves are saying didn't really appeal to me.
And just to be clear, like, it's the charm that I think was kind of more of a pity thing. Not necessarily the music or what people find to be genius. Because I know art is interpreted in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. The things that I might find beautiful and amazing, someone else can look at and say it's complete trash or rubbish and whatnot. I think that he definitely, there's a reason behind these major artists. I mean, who was it just recently? Lana Del Rey redid one of his songs last year for a short film about him. I mean, he's still drawing in these huge artists. There's something there that I'm not seeing. I'm well aware. But when it came to the charm part is where I kind of disagreed.
All right. So let's move on to talk about his family.
All right. Can I?
Go ahead.
All right. Well, his mother. I had this reaction to her that was similar to, like, the mom in Ordinary People.
Tell us more.
She was very strong. I didn't like she kept telling. It was like when he finally had came back to stay with them, and he had a year of extreme just staying in bed.
Depression.
Shortly after that, she had said he always wanted to go somewhere. And so they had been making this commentary about, you know, here's his, like, habits, here's what he likes to do, here's the little tidbits. And then it became, well, that's all great and all, but I wish he was just normal. It was almost as if, working with that family, what are the things that we can change, and when are we going to accept? Like, he's still her son, but this is a part of, you know, his symptoms, this is how they manifest, and when do you accept that he has some mental health concerns and then move forward versus saying, all right, you had a job, but then you came back home and you're getting out of bed now and you have a little band. It was almost as if critiquing him for these things instead of embracing, like, there's a set of strangers that didn't know my son that asked him to join their band. And even with all this information about how he's been, look at where he's at now, and he's still able to do certain things. It was almost as if, like, yeah, he's still not normal. He didn't go out, get a job, get a family, and have that standard life.
As well.
So.
Yeah. I mean, I think that happens a lot with a lot of parents who have any child who suffers from... I was working with children who were somewhere on the autism spectrum,
mm-hmm.
and we heard that a lot from them. It was almost the why us? Like, we just wish he didn't have this or she didn't have this. And, like, a lot of times I'd say, you know, like, I'm working with your kid. Like, it's really, like, I feel for you, and I'm sorry that you're feeling this way, but you need to go see someone and talk to someone about that yourself. Like, I'm working with your child who has these things. You're dealing with a grief and a loss on your own, and I feel like the parents were definitely going through that.
And sometimes the denial, where it's like,
yes.
No, it's just a phase. No,
yeah.
there's something that can happen that can, quote-unquote, fix
yeah.
my kid.
Yeah, that's what I was feeling. That she wanted something to be fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And it just...
It's not going to happen.
And I think it's important to talk about the setting in which he grew up, where it was a rural West Virginia, household.
Mm-hmm.
That was, I think they said, fundamentalist, religious, kind of... You know, just rural, traditional family setting that may not have been educated about mental illness or how to deal with mental illness or creativity. So, you know, maybe in a smaller town, it was, I guess, for them more appropriate to be normal, to fit in, and that was the definition of success and in living, you know, a wholesome life. And you know, Daniel Johnson started to exhibit these weird, you know, like drawing eyeballs on the school. And sure, it was seen like, oh, it's just a prank. Oh, you know, that's how he's expressing himself. And it wasn't seen as much as a threat, more of like, oh, he'll grow out of it.
The early stages, for sure.
Mm-hmm. My impression was that in the scenes that were from the past,
mm-hmm.
in the film, that then we saw instances of his mother, Mabel, being sort of this religious fundamentalist and trying to bring him up in that way and being frustrated with him being an unprofitable servant. And of course, he, in his clever twisting of words, would say he was an unserviceable prophet. But I felt like in the scenes that were modern day at the time of the filming with her and his dad, I thought she had come to a new understanding of the extent of his illness. And so I felt like she was different. And I kind of felt like she was a little bit of a saint as well as his dad for putting up with him now.
Yeah.
But there definitely was that upbringing in this strictly religious setting that may have affected his delusions in the future.
And just the fear they have now of, they're well aware that they're elderly and they probably don't have
yes.
a ton of time left
mm-hmm.
on this planet, and that he's going to outlive them probably. And who is going to take care of him now?
Yeah.
And I don't even know if they're still alive in present day.
Mm.
I mean, this film came out in what year?
2005.
Okay, and so it was probably filmed a couple years before that.
Good point.
The one knowledge that I have of something closer to the present, and I think this is where the Lana Del Rey song is. So I watched a 2015 short film that Daniel made, I don't
yeah.
know if you guys watched that, where he has a conversation with his past self. And it's interesting for many reasons. One is we don't actually ever hear from modern day Daniel in this documentary, which was a style of, it's a documentary style. But in this 2015 short film, we've got the frog much larger, reflective of how he is larger in size now. And he tells his earlier self things like, start taking the antidepressants earlier. And he also acknowledges that there never really was a chance with Lori. And so maybe to move on from that And on that Laurie topic, we're kind of going all over the place. I did feel like, as his friend said in the film, that he channeled his feelings toward Laurie. She became like his muse. Mm-hmm. So it was almost archetypal. He didn't stalk her. He used her as an inspiration mm-hmm. for lots of songs.
Yeah.
Didn't he like follow her around though?
I don't think he was more stalkerish as much as like cutesy. Well, he was
maybe
taking,
at the very beginning
yeah,
when
the beginning,
he was filming.
He was yeah. filming.
It's a fine line between cutesy and following someone with a
camera.
She
didn't seem very
I see that line is very bold.
She, well, the
I mean,
thing
she
was
okay with it, so.
She didn't feel distressed at
yeah.
at the videos that we saw. We don't know, obviously, like how their relationship was past that. But
sure.
I mean, at
she
the
seemed
theater,
to
she didn't
like
see
the
that.
Attention.
Yeah. Run.
He was very, but you could tell how he felt about her because even at the funeral, he said that, oh, there's an open casket, I should just go lay in.
Yeah, like I said, he was very open about his feelings. Like, his friend who ended up marrying Kathy, that to, I think his friend name was Dave, right?
I think so.
He writes, is that a song or just an audio recording that he had?
Audio recording, I think.
And he was explaining, like, out of all the people who would have known it would be today, my friend, but he says, because he has Kathy, you know, I think he called him a beautiful soul or something like that. Like, he had his ways of just, it's just like, wow. And you understand there is some things going on. But he's human too. He has these emotions.
Yeah. You said that Kurt Cobain is his biggest fan, or he's Kurt Cobain's biggest fan?
Kurt Cobain was a huge fan of Daniel Johnston.
Okay.
To the extent that he would intentionally wear his Daniel Johnston shirt to important photo shoots, like I believe the cover of Rolling Stone, so that he's indirectly promoting Daniel Johnston.
Okay, I remember you said that earlier, and I was going to say that that makes sense because Daniel's very angsty and in your face, and like, I'm going to tell you how I feel whether you like it or not, and I've never really listened to Kurt Cobain,
but
I do know he was known for the same type of, okay, don't get mad,
no,
but he was part of Nirvana, right?
Yes.
Okay. I don't want to make anybody
upset. I even
love
that you said the Nirvana.
I know there was like one song, like Smells Like
Teen Spirit.
Yes, I know that one song.
Yeah.
But that was
it's
very
angsty.
Like,
yeah. Well, I mean, you were probably pretty young when they came out. It's forgivable.
So I could see the similarities. So that was my little piece.
Yeah. I mean, I was reading something at some point with the Metallica connection, Kurt Cobain, and even the Butthole Surfers. And that someone said the reason they thought he had this whole kind of revamp for a little bit was because of other people discovering his music.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that hadn't it been for that, they didn't even think like there would be a chance of this documentary being made. Like it really
yeah.
was other artists that were
yeah.
like, hey, take a look at this guy.
Yeah, I think that's probably entirely correct. There is a thread on the Internet Movie Database that essentially says Daniel only became popular from Kurt wearing his shirt.
Yeah.
However, he did end up becoming really appealing to a lot of people. And so, Tony, as you were talking about Kurt Cobain, boy, Kurt certainly struggled with mental health issues as well. And so probably could identify and sort of wanted to champion this underdog of Daniel Johnston.
Yeah. And I still see this as a tragic story because of that potential that we see, the potential for that creativity, that genius, and maybe even a niche of music that could rise up to fame, but it's pushed back, or there's a barrier there that mental health made for Daniel Johnston that made him unable to fulfill that potential in a socially appropriate way that could propagate his career.
Mm. Then there's the question of which came first. Would he be as artsy and artistic without him having the mental...
See, that's the thing. I don't think we can separate the two.
No.
And that's also that spectrum.
Yeah. I think there's an intersectionality of those two constructs, sure. For sure. And as represented in those other films that I had mentioned.
Yeah. But you can also be very artistic and a powerhouse in the art world without having mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sure. Adam, I sort of veered the topic away from his family and parents, and I seemed like you had some ideas.
There was very much of the film that I couldn't identify with. I found myself getting distracted, having to go back repeatedly and try to watch a scene again, or what happened here? How did we get to this spot? But there was like a part with his father, and when he was talking about the plane crash.
Yes.
So they had performed, and it seemed like it was a pretty big performance.
That was the one that I was mentioning.
Yeah.
Like the last charm, when he was off of his medication, and that Austin.
Yeah, and he came back out and performed like even a follow up. The
yeah.
audience was loving him.
Yeah.
And him and his father. His father was a pilot, and they took off in a small 2-person plane, and Daniel had a delusion where he actually somehow thought, or it was alluding to the fact that he was Casper the Ghost or something, and he took the plane out of the, or the key out of the plane's ignition and threw it out the window. And his father had flown for some war, I believe, and was able to successfully land the plane even though it did crash and everything. And when his father was describing just that mental breakdown and not being able to recognize his own son, had quit taking the medication, I had this emotional reaction watching, and his father's crying, who didn't really show a ton of emotion throughout the film. It was beautiful and terrifying all at once, and I was just so drawn in, and it was so surprising to me because I had such a disconnect with a lot of the other parts of the film that, I don't know, I was just very, very moved.
What do you think it was about that?
I think the parents just want the best for their kids, and they love their kids, and he had blame. He was blaming himself a little, and he was scared about where Daniel was going to end up. If he saw one of his biggest... Like, Daniel do one of the biggest things that could have ended both their lives. And he was able to save it. Like, when he's gone, who's going to do that now? He was scared.
Question.
Fear.
I didn't understand, because I'm assuming they were in a little, like,
yes.
Like one of the
little
planes.
It was a 2-seater.
Those have windows that open?
Yes.
Yeah, they're kind of older models.
Okay. Cause
they're not flying very high.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of like those planes that go over the cornfields.
Oh,
like a crop duster.
Like a
crop duster.
They have
it wasn't like
windows.
It's not
like
flying
little...
like, you know,
okay.
Hundreds, thousands of miles.
Cause I was really like, how did he throw? If you know, you got to take science into it with the
suction,
altitude
and yeah.
No,
like, how did he do that?
Yeah, and unless, actually, it's funny, I wouldn't have known that either, except my grandfather was a pilot, and he wanted his ashes spread out of a plane over his property, and I was like, how in the world do you think we're going to do that? And then we went on this tiny little one, and that's how I found out. So.
Well, and I really, I just want to come back to this scene,
yeah.
that is the most powerful scene of the whole film
mm-hmm.
for me. When I'm sitting by myself and no one else is around, I get teary-eyed myself, empathizing with Daniel's father. How, to say frightening is an understatement, that must have been. And you can tell just from a behavioral conditioned response that even in retelling it, Daniel's father is reliving part of it, and he does get teary-eyed, more than teary-eyed. And I think it is that whole gestalt going on of when we die, who's going to protect him. So there's just that's just really powerful. I also loved, Adam, how you described it, something like tragic and beautiful or something like that. So powerful.
And I really disliked his mom in the beginning. Like, I had this like anger toward her for like some of the things that she said to him. Like, how could you talk to your child like that? And then as it went on, I felt the same kind of sainthood thing that you described. I totally switched roles with her.
It didn't switch for me.
No?
No.
I just, Because I believe the part that I'm referencing about her wanting him to be normal is after all of this happens. I believe it's towards the end. And so it's almost as if his whole life he's been into art and music and all these things. And she kind of mentions as, I wish he would get out of this. You know, he likes his art thing and just blows it off. And he's still doing it even when he comes back home with them. And it's like, why can't you do anything else? And it's one of those things where I see people tend to focus on the deficit versus what he can do. And I think his art, his music, it keeps him going. That in itself, he gets up for it. He's excited. Things like that, embracing them versus trying to put normal barriers of go work a 9-to-5, do all these other things, which would probably bother him and cause distress.
Yeah.
But he might have a little bit better of a chance of being able to pay for a home and food. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, because she's not going to live forever. I see what you're saying, and I definitely agree that that is sad. But I also, like, I've talked to parents of, like, LGBT youths who wish that their kid was quote-unquote normal or typical or heterosexual because it's an easier life. Not because they dislike their child or want their child to be different, but they want their child to have an easier life.
And throughout the film and throughout his life, as he was growing up, I think they've started to accept certain things. There was one point where he went off to college and they could see that this was not working for him. And so they took him back home and they were like, well, he feels better. We see our old Daniel back again once he's, you know, been living at home for a little bit. But I also think it's difficult because in their whole life, they have experienced one way of living, and perhaps their neighbors and their other family members have been in this lifestyle, and it may be difficult to imagine or to support something that is unknown and something that is like something that caused their child to be unsafe. And like kind of like he went to New York and then he had a breakdown.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be this like protective feeling, like I don't want my kid to experience that again. Mm-hmm. Like,
well, then there's even the brother and the sister who both had kind of tried to help him at certain points. He lived with his sister for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then he come to visit for like a holiday, I think Christmas.
Yeah.
And they had to get him like a ticket.
He's escorted out.
Oh, yeah. Well, he had put the number 9 in big black letters. And then in a later scene, we see him making reference to Revolution Number 9 by the Beatles, which is that, if you don't know, it's the oddest song the Beatles ever recorded. It was John Lennon. It's just a series of voices and bits strewn together. It's not actual music, and it's quite long. It's like 9 or so minutes long. And that was and Charles Manson had fixated on that song as part of as well as Helter Skelter. They're both on the White Album.
He also said during the performance, like the different numbers, and that 9 was significant of humans, I think. He said that 7 was
7
God,
was like God
6
and religious,
was devil.
8 was,
that from the
8.
The Pixies song? It goes, and
I thought
the
that
devil
was his.
Is, and the devil is 6. If the devil is 6, then God is 7. God is 7.
No idea.
It comes out from that.
Yeah.
It's a Pixie song called This Monkey's Gone to Heaven.
I thought that was his song.
Maybe
because they referenced it in there.
Maybe I'm mixing his song with a Pixie song, though.
Yeah, maybe. Well, when he started preaching to the audience, he
was
making references to the numbers. And I think he said number 9 is for humans or for like people or something like that. But I think the what got his family was the altercation that he had with a family member about putting a Beatles album on.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
He broke his brother's rib.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah,
and
fighting over that.
Yeah. And then he took off to the room the kids were in, like, in kind of a manic state when they decided, like, you've got to go.
Yeah,
sure.
So, I mean...
So, it was difficult.
There were some really scary things that he, you know, there was a lot of things that were, like, I had the empathy and the sympathy for, and then there were other things that were, like, I don't think I could deal with that either. That's
sure.
a lot.
Yeah, but I did like that they showed all these things, and
mm-hmm.
it wasn't like a sugarcoating anything. It was like, yes, he's hurt members of his own family. He's scared people. He's like been in these life or death situations because that's what it is to have bipolar. It's not just like, oh, you're happy for like a month and then you're sad for a month. It's literally like all this stuff wrapped in one.
Yeah.
So aside from like, you know, his music and career and stuff, like, I did like how the movie was very, like, in your face. Well, like, the documentary was in
Absolutely.
Your face with how bipolar is, because not many people really know about it. They just think it's like, oh,
yes.
I'm so happy. And then it's just like,
I think I've even said
so
it in these
sad.
Before. Like, the number one thing that drives me nuts is when clients come in and they're like, I'm bipolar. I'm happy one minute and sad the next. And I'm like, that's
no,
not bipolar.
No,
those
exactly.
are feelings.
Okay, you have feelings.
I thought this was an awesome representation of what that illness actually looks like, how it manifests in a person, and how it's not just happy and sad.
It's confusion.
It is a lot.
Frustration.
Yeah.
But I think that also goes back to society and just the way people say things. Oh, you're cold one minute, you're hot the next. Oh, you're bipolar,
mm-hmm.
you're acting this way. And it's like, you really... say things, or you're being antisocial. All these different things that people throw out and
very
not using
different in
them.
The clinical world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, good point.
So.
Okay, and I did a little Googling while we've been talking. I am sad to report that Mabel passed away in September 2010, but his father Bill is still alive.
Mm-hmm.
I think. You said in his earlier, well, like later special or movie that he
was
talking
about. Oh, like a little 15-minute short film.
I think that the fact that you said that he was addressing all these things from the older documentary about how he should have taken antidepressants earlier and he shouldn't have been fixated on the girl, I think that's a sign that he's a lot better now. So even though his parents, well, both of his parents aren't there, maybe... he got on like a medication regimen and he
does seem stable, and he continues to tour. Like, we could go see him perform.
I might sit that one out.
Well,
Tony, you're funny.
Oh, Tony.
Well,
Tony, you've got to learn how to form an opinion.
and I want to acknowledge again, this style of documentary
mm-hmm.
was one in which we never heard, on purpose, we never heard from modern day
yeah.
Daniel.
It reminded me a little, have you seen the newer documentary, Amy, that came out at One Best Documentary with the...
I have not, it's on my to-watch list.
I'll let you borrow it,
okay.
I own it, it's great, fantastic. But it was a post-mortem, so of course it had her speaking to cameras, but not directly to the filmmakers.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I kind of like... I like the idea of the... not... if it's, like, from, like, earlier, you don't hear from modern... like, the person it's about are, like, modern people, just because you get to capture what was going on at the time. It's a little less,
and
like...
it was incredible seeing other people's reactions to his... mental health issues.
Mm-hmm.
I think if we heard it just from him, it would have been an even harder thing to identify with. But hearing it from like the dad was when it drew me in and was like, oh my gosh, I'm back into this. Like, how in the world are friends and family and managers? And
I was a little creeped out about the guy that was interviewed while
getting
his teeth done.
Yes.
That was Gibby Hayes or Haynes, who's the lead singer of the Butthole Surfers.
I
just
like kind of added
to
the little disturbing
yeah.
aspect
yeah.
of the documentary. And I don't know how I feel
yeah.
about that.
It's like, oh no, I never gave him acid while I'm getting a crown on my teeth.
Yeah.
It was almost too up close and personal. I don't want to know how many cavities you have.
Now, another documentary that came out around the same time and that I'm going to say has a more, also has creativity and maybe some hypomanic expressions is called Danielson, a family movie. And Daniel Johnston does have a cameo appearance. We see him backstage visiting this other band. Mm. And he comes across as completely stable. And he's just, and he mentions how easy it is to fall into the where are they now category. Mm. That
yeah.
people forget you easily.
Yeah. Mm. And there was many times in the documentary where he was on his medication and he seemed to have things together. And just a reminder how easy it is to slip from that, especially if the person is convinced that perhaps they don't have anything wrong with them or they don't need medication or that, you know, everything's fine and dandy. But it may cause harm to the person, especially if he disagrees with their caretakers. Like if they're like, here's your medication, and they don't believe it or trust it.
Yeah, sometimes clients don't realize like the reason they feel so good, the reason things are working is because you're medicated and your medication's working, and they think like, well, now I don't need it. I'm not having delusions. I'm not having manic thoughts or depression. I don't need this medication. It does dull people, and it does make them feel differently and like they're not themselves.
And it takes away sex drive.
Yeah.
And, as we see with Daniel, intense bloating. And so in theory, I like to take the stand that I respect somebody's decision to not take medication because the symptoms are worse than the mental health concerns. Of course, except when harm or danger is involved, which seems to have been Daniel's case.
Yeah, agreed.
But also in the relative beginning, like in his young adulthood, he was not on medication and he did not believe that there, you know, he was experiencing delusion or that he was having difficulties. Back in that drug period and the... like people started noticing that he was kind of weird, but he was like, oh no, I'm totally fine. But the thing is, how do we, not necessarily convince, but support the client in a way that may lead to treatment or may lead to counseling or medication that does not interfere with their freedom?
I would assume the same kind of way of like helping any client through the stages of change who are in that pre-contemplation and they don't want to see change and don't even really know there's a problem yet and slowly starting to work the way through that.
Well, yeah, in Daniel's, when Daniel was a teenager, this is pre-acid, and even maybe during the time when he was filming Lori, it almost seemed like he had the perfect, I'll call it a cocktail, but the perfect combination of just a little bit of manic features that propelled him and gave him energy, and that fueled partially his creativity, and he wasn't hurting anybody. And then at some point it went over the edge.
When she was at that young adult age where a lot of mental health issues tend to surface.
Yeah.
I bet the acid did not help.
No.
Agreed.
I'm sure that exacerbated everything.
Yeah. Well, I think drugs and alcohol do bring out a ton of mental health issues that were maybe below the surface that could arise, which is why we can never diagnose when someone is using any kind of substances.
Yeah, isn't one of the like side effects, isn't one of the reasons people take like acid or something is because it gives you like nice delusions or... something and it...
Well, I've heard that.
I'm just going off...
actually going to relate that. In the beginning, he was smoking a lot of marijuana with his manager and then traveled to acid. And I wonder if the reason why he got hooked on acid was because of how he was feeling internally and whether it was... not syncing, but meshing with some of the things that he was experiencing.
Was he hooked on it? I never got that impression.
He did it for a period of time.
Okay.
Like, he constantly...
What I have heard, I'm not that familiar with LSD. I have heard that it's not addictive, but he was ingesting it. I mean, during that time period where we saw Gibby in, or Gabby in the dentist chair and reflecting back, that up through going to New York and disappearing, that was a heavy acid time for him. And it, and there may have been something he got from that, or it meshed, like you said.
So, yeah.
I was surprised we had a lot of, we were like.
That you were saying. That
we
were
saying. We never agreed.
Out of everyone here, would you have thought you and me would have?
That's funny.
Was there a cliche part of the movie?
I don't think there can be a lot with documentaries unless it's being forced, and I didn't feel like anything was being forced in this documentary. I didn't think they came in with a preconceived notion of where they wanted to go with it. They kind of let it happen.
There was a part, though, where his artwork was exhibited in a gallery, and not in relation to cliche, but that there was a part where the owner or the exhibitor said that about 98% of his artwork was sold to a collector, and I was wondering what happened to those proceeds. Maybe perhaps it wasn't as much money, or what happened with that?
Yeah.
Did he
get
the money?
Just look though at the art, it wasn't something that people were paying top dollar for. It was on computer paper and probably, you know, I mean, it just...
Yeah, like a marker.
It really was.
Well, I will say in my personal experience, a friend of mine, I can't remember if I contributed to this or not, but a good friend of mine purchased a Daniel Johnston large doodle of the frog with an autograph for a couple hundred dollars. On eBay.
The other thing that I noticed within the film was that some people were making money off of his creations without his knowledge. Like, for instance, the manager that got gypped, he was purchasing a lot of his artwork, or like some, I think also mention of some of his songs that were re-recorded and then released without his knowledge or benefit.
Yeah.
So,
but anyway,
I'm trying to see where. It doesn't really say on Wikipedia like where all that stuff went.
Yeah.
It just says where it was exhibited.
All right, so interesting character. And I feel like maybe we've come to a wrap-up point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was definitely different this time around, but this is the first of two documentaries we will be reviewing during our time. Next week, however, we will be taking a look at A Beautiful Mind. And following that, we will be looking at the second documentary, Stevie. So tune in next Monday.
And I just I want to point out again, thank you so much for listening.
Yes, thank you.
And sign up on our, we have a Facebook page. We're available on iTunes and Google Play. thank you for comments that people have left. If you leave comments on iTunes, that helps promote us and gets even more people to listen. If you have constructive feedback, which we welcome, please email that to us at mentalillnessandpopculture@gmail.com.
If you see us on campus, say hi.
That's cute.
All right.
All right.
All right.
Thanks so much, guys.
All right.
See ya.
Bye.
On our way.